All right, Richard, now there are many things we can talk about tonight, and of course we're going to delve into this sort of this PBB, I call it, the Polar Bear Bible. So, but before we explore this wonderful exploration of this incredible iconic creature, there are some other parts of your world, your life experience, that I think would add a richness to this journey tonight. More often than not, someone like yourself, when you probably get an interview done, it's your standard journalist with a background in English. But I have a background in biology and science, so I think that gives us a chance to really explore things at a different level and open it up to the audience in a way that they can glean little bits of treasure from your life experience. So before we get into the magic of polar bears, how does one, or explain to us your journey from naturalist to artist and then to author?
It's a long journey. I hope everybody's comfortable. I was always the kid who drew. I mean, everybody's class has somebody in it who, rather than paying attention, is doodling. Well, that was always me. And I was always drawing animals. And I thought that this was entertainment enough. And so I lived in New York, still do, and I would go as a child to the Natural History Museum in New York, and I would sit in front of the dioramas, and I would draw the animals in the dioramas. I liked doing that so much so.
You had sort of your own night at the museum. Yeah.
I had my own days day after day at the museum. And I fell in love with the museum at that moment, and I thought that the best thing one could ever do with one's life was to paint one of those diorama backgrounds. Well, there were some hiccups and some interruptions along the way, but eventually I went to work at the Natural History Museum as an exhibit designer, and one of my assignments was to paint a diorama background. And this was the fulfillment of my life's ambition. The trouble was...
How old were you?
26.
Yeah.
And I had done everything I'd ever wanted to do with my life, and I had to figure something else to do. And ultimately, I began drawing and painting and designing exhibits elsewhere, and that led to the writing of these books. The painting actually came first. I did the paintings,
right,
and then kind of wrote the books and around them.
And your paintings have been featured in a lot of journals and publications, and you've done prints and you know, wonderful work that beautifully mirrors the world of nature. But what part of you is the artist and what part of you is the scientist? Or the naturalist or the interpreter?
All parts of me are both, because through the paintings and the drawings and through the writing and the lectures and the designing, whatever else it is, my mission, if you will, having achieved my life's goal at 26, but my mission has always been to communicate the wonders of life on Earth and how fascinating every element of it is. So if it were necessary to have a drawing, I would draw it. If it were necessary to write a chapter about giant squid, I would do it. If necessary, go diving with sharks in Australia, I would do it. But it was all being done with the idea of communicating the magic and the wonder and the importance of natural history.
As a naturalist, and I'd like to refer to you as a naturalist, sometimes people will say, well, are you a wildlife biologist? Are you an ecologist? And I would say, well, I'm sort of all those things. And my manifestation today, I'm an interpreter of the natural world, so I feel very comfortable with the word naturalist. Darwin was a naturalist. But if we were to look at you as a naturalist, what I think is interesting is that when we look at the old model of a naturalist, he or she was an observer, you took data, but this prior to photography, you did sketches and you did drawings and illustrations. How important is it to a naturalist today to touch and maintain and exercise those skills?
I use whatever skills I have as a communicator. I see myself as a biologist, as a naturalist, as a student of natural history, as a researcher, But mostly I take these things, if I possibly can, and consolidate them, because I want to make something, no matter what it is, a drawing, a painting, a book, that will get people excited about the subject matter. So the background material, the drawing, the sketching, is not nearly as important to me as the being able to get it out to the public.
To basically package it and get it to the people that need the information.
I started doing this in the most peculiar way when I began to get involved with whale conservation, which was actually the first area I worked in. I would stand on street corners with other whale huggers with a petition, and we would shout, this is Manhattan, and we would shout, save the whales, boycott Soviet and Japanese goods. And the idea that we had in our naivete was that if we got enough people to sign these petitions, we would run them over to the Soviet embassy and hand the petition with 200 names on it, and the Soviet ambassador would say, oh yes, very good, we stop whaling now. Well, of course that didn't work, but I recognized that I had
should just go with the blowgun and some sarin pellets. That'll do the quick ones.
Or I could have served vodka to people. Yeah. But the point was that I recognized that I could get to more people by writing a book or a magazine article. So I stopped standing around on street corners.
I guess what I'm looking for is the naturalist of the 19th century would really have had to develop good drawing skills, because if he was going into the field, when Wallace was in the field, he wouldn't be relying on a lot of photography to take back data, in addition to specimens.
Because it wasn't invented when he was
exactly.
In the field.
You know, or what he brought back all packaged up and ready to present to intellectual society. But having those skills, being able to paint a picture or a painting or draw a picture, sketch, does that make you a better naturalist?
No, but it makes me a better communicator. I'm not sure that the word naturalist is immediately applicable. I mm-hmm. study the natural world. I write about the natural world. I paint pictures of it. But I'd much rather see myself not as somebody who studies it, but rather takes the information
and
dispenses it. So that a lot of naturalists I know, and a lot of naturalists you know, stay in their labs, and they measure things, and they classify right. things, and that certainly qualifies them to be naturalists, but it doesn't necessarily qualify them to be communicators. I mean, great example of a naturalist communicator nowadays is Ed Wilson, E.O. Wilson, right. who spent a lot of time classifying and studying ants, but then took that information and turned it into Pulitzer Prize-winning books, and recently into a novel, so that this is a naturalist who communicates. I see myself as a sort of semi-naturalist who communicates first and foremost.
As someone who reaches into the natural world and takes that information, the complexities of life as it flows from one species to the next, and the issues of conflict and the challenges of conservation, when you go to present that information, would you consider yourself a specialist or a generalist? Are you interested in all things or specific things? We know you are interested in polar bears.
I'm interested in a lot of things. I recognized early on that there were some areas where nothing had been done, and I therefore jumped in. There were no books about whales. There hadn't been a book written about whales since 1900, when I wrote The Book of Whales in 1980. And for that book, I did a lot of paintings of whales and a lot of drawings of whales. I think it's important to have chosen or had this field choose me. I didn't necessarily choose it. But there was a big vacuum there. People didn't know what whales looked like. And one of the reasons I painted them was because I was so deeply involved with whale conservation. Ultimately, I was on the International Whaling Commission for 10 years. But I was involved with whale conservation and believed that people wouldn't care about saving whales if they had no idea what they looked like. So I would draw them, and that would make bumper stickers and buttons and T-shirts and whatever, so that people would have a sense of what the animals were that they were supposed to be caring about. Mm-hmm. So from whales, I went on to other things. I probably should have stuck with whales. But so many things interested me, so many other things came up, and it's all kind of an organic progression. From the whales, I went right to dolphins. From dolphins, I went to whaling history. From whaling history, I went to sea monsters. Sea monsters, I went to giant squid. And every one thing comes out of another. And it's always been that way. I never sit around and scratch my head and say, what'll I do next? I know what's coming next, because as I write about it in an abbreviated fashion, I know that I want to expand this. I want to turn this into a full-scale study.
I can see the way that journey sort of snakes, and you connect the dots from a whale to a dolphin to sea monsters to the legends of and the stories of whale hunting. I know we talked earlier when we were in New York City at the Papaya King. We met serendipitously at the airport. He says, oh, I'm going to be seeing you tomorrow. I'm like, oh, yes, you will. So, and it seems logical to look at Architeuthis, the giant squid and the monstrous predator that consumes it. But how do you get from the history of whaling and these incredible creatures to a dolphin's tail?
Well, they're all connected. Everything is interconnected, one with the other. It's hard, in fact, it's hard to write these things and segregate your subject matter without it kind of leaking out into other areas. I tend to write a lot in footnotes, and the footnotes often come as a surprise to me when I say, gee, I didn't know that. Why don't I work on this? And I have to control myself so as not to wander away and do something about a weird... I just wrote one, for example. I'm writing about sperm whales, about how large the brain is. The sperm whale has the largest brain of any animal that has ever lived on Earth. And so I'm writing that sperm whales have these very large brains, and then I remembered that there's a fish that has a larger brain-to-body ratio than humans do.
What fish is that?
That's called a momaira, the elephant fish. And for whatever reason, nobody understands why that might be. Fish are not known for their intellectual capabilities. But here's a fish with a larger brain relative to its body, something this big, but its brain is 60% of its body weight. If you had a brain that was 60% of your body weight, you'd have a 75-pound brain.
It'd be a big brain.
It would be a
yes.
Big brain. So anyway, the things just grow from one to the other. And as I say, it's sometimes difficult to keep it contained. It's very easy to have it branch out and go from one thing to the next.
Before we get into polar bears, just two questions. You've been doing this for many decades.
Thank you.
But not... within reason. And do you still enjoy your work? Do you still love it?
I do. I do. I think that I feel extraordinarily lucky to have been able to do this stuff. Every once in a while, now it's becoming more frequent than it used to, but every once in a while I think, what has it all been worth? Have I saved anything? Have I raised enough consciousness? But then I think to myself, well, I did the best job I could. I did what I could do. I drew the pictures. I wrote the books. I did the lectures. I did all of it. And I'm happy with what I did. I'm content with what I did. And I always look forward to the next thing. And as I said, the next thing grows right out of the one that preceded it.
So you've spent a number of decades really focusing on the story of many of these creatures, but a good portion of your professional life and your personal passion has been around cetaceans, have been around whales and dolphins. I imagine in your career you've seen a real roller coaster ride with these species, especially when it comes to conservation. Are we better off today in our management of cetaceans than we were when you first started?
Absolutely. I don't think it had a whole lot to do with me, but I think we are much better off now. I was on the Whaling Commission in July of 1983 when the moratorium was passed on commercial whaling. That was essentially the conclusion of commercial whaling. All the whaling countries were voted out of business. Some of them, like Japan and the Soviet Union, didn't go willingly, but they did. They shut down, except for Japan. they shut down, and for a very long period of time, there has been no commercial whaling. Norway took an exception to the resolution that was passed in 1983, and by doing that, that meant they didn't have to abide by it. So Norway has always been, since then and before then, has been whaling more or less legally. The Japanese have been whaling under the rubric of a scientific research permit. This is a little complicated, but it gives them the right to kill a certain number of whales every year. Unfortunately, the whales always end up in the meat markets instead of in the labs, but that's another story. Now we are a whole lot better off than we were when in 1960. Most people think that the heyday of commercial whaling was during the time of Moby Dick. Moby Dick was written in 1850. It wasn't. More whales were killed in the 1960s every year than were killed in the entire Yankee whale fishery, because they were killing them by mechanized means. They were shooting them with cannons. They were blowing them up. They had all these fancy ways of processing them on board ships. There were 25,000 sperm whales being killed every year by the Russians and the Soviets and the Japanese in 1965 and 1966. Since then, a lot of whale species have been spared. Now, whether or not that means that they're going to bounce back, that's another issue altogether, but they're not killing them. There is a rumor that at the IWC meeting, the Whaling Commission meeting this year in July, that the moratorium is going to be overturned, which will mean a return by some countries, not everybody, but some countries, to commercial whaling. This is a punch in the stomach to those of us who fought so hard for the moratorium, but it is in no way comparable, nor will it be again comparable to the number of whales that were killed at the heyday of commercial whaling. So we are, in fact, a lot better off. The only real problem with it now is that it was, when it was passed, considered the most important triumph of the environmental movement. We stopped them from killing whales, we thought. We didn't ever truly succeed in doing that, and so they may go back and do it again. But still, putting all these countries out of the whaling business was a very important thing, and now the numbers, even if they go back next year and start killing whales, the numbers are going to be double digits,
so
triple digits.
So there's been vast improvement in the way we manage these species, and we've seen the recovery of a number of these species. What is your opinion on the differences between, you know, industrialized, massive whale hunting, commercial whaling, versus something like subsistence, something like a remote community in Alaska? Do you see a difference, or are they the same? Like, for example, we could have a community of Inuit folks up there, and what they will say is that they would harvest one whale a year, or it's eaten by the whole village. Is that something different? Can they be looked at differently, or do they sort of get grouped together?
It's a complicated question, because they ought to be looked at differently, but quite often they're not. I was on the Whaling Commission when the issues of Inuit whaling on bowheads came up, and what had happened, which was unforeseeable, let alone unforeseen, was that when the pipeline went in Alaska, enough Inuits went to work on the pipeline and made so much money that they themselves became what had been previously reserved for village elders. They became whaling captains. They had enough money to buy a whaleboat and a motor and a gun to shoot the whales with, and instead of adhering to the old ways of killing whales, suddenly, instead of killing one whale for the village, they were killing 79 whales, 140 whales. They were just shooting them randomly because it was important to the culture. This was cut back. And so eventually the killing of bowhead whales by Aboriginal peoples came more or less under control. But when it started, it skyrocketed. It turned into a rodeo of whale killing. And that's why everybody on the Whaling Commission became so exercised about it and tried to shut it down, because it wasn't being conducted in a traditional fashion. It was being conducted in an out-of-control fashion. Now we're, by the way, when we started on this, we didn't know how many bowhead whales there were. And the numbers that were first brought in were something on the neighborhood of 2,000 whales. And taking 120 whales per annum out of a population of 2,000 is not a good thing to do. Subsequently, we learned that there were a lot more. We learned how to find bowhead whales by triangulating their songs. Bowhead whales sing, as do humpback whales. And so we learned how many more there were. It is different insofar as it's traditional. The Japanese, by the way, argue they've always been whaling, right. So that's traditional whaling. They don't see a difference. There is, of course, a difference.
So my last question then regarding whales before we move on. So is it a reasonable argument then to say there are cultural reasons which are compelling and powerful enough that allow this community sort of an exclusive access to this resource versus commercial whaling? Do you think that's fair? And when you look at a whale, and I only say this because the way I've looked at animals in life has really evolved over the years, especially as I've gone into the fields of wildlife management. And when you look at a whale, do you see something that's spectacular, unique, that touches your heart, or do you see a very important natural resource and species that can be managed?
Do I see?
Yes.
I see what you see. I see the most spectacular animals on Earth. I feel that if there was a way to prevent anybody from killing any whales, traditions notwithstanding, I would do that. But I respect the need of the Inuits to take an occasional whale or a couple of whales, so that I am not exclusively in favor on the side of the whales, although mostly I am. And so I recognize the need of the Inuits to do that. But there is nothing comparable, and you know this because you've done it. There's, if you've ever either been in the water or even been in a boat when whales go by, the first time this happens to you, it takes your breath away. You cannot believe that there's anything that big. And this doesn't have to be the biggest whales. This can be some of the smaller whales. I used to lead trips to Baja California, and we would see the gray whales in Magdalena Bay. And the first time people ever see a gray whale, because you look down over the pontoons of the Zodiac, and there's this giant thing, it really takes your breath away. Of course, it terrifies a lot of people. I think the whale's going to dump them in the water and eat them. But in fact, this is what I've been talking about all this time, is communicating the wonder and the magic. I can't get a 40-foot whale in a 9x12 book. But in fact, if I can try and explain what it feels like to see a whale for the first time, then I think I've done my job. So I would prefer that people would appreciate and respect wildlife because it is worth respecting and worth appreciating, and not because it has some economic value to them.
Explain the genesis of this fantastic journey of the life of the polar bear. What made you explore the natural history, the issues of conservation, the evolution of this amazing bear?
Basically, like everybody else, I began to hear about global warming. Everybody has heard early on, has heard about it. I did a lot of research on the history of global warming. It's not a phenomenon that suddenly popped up in 1990. It's been around for a long time. People have been aware of it since the mid-19th century, that is, with the Industrial Revolution, and as we began spewing gases into the atmosphere, some people recognized that this probably wasn't so good for the atmosphere. But when James Hansen particularly began his crusade to make people aware of global warming, the subject of global warming appeared on the front pages of newspaper and on television programs, and people went up to the Arctic and filmed animals in trouble, whether walruses or narwhals or whatever it was. And I realized, of course, that with my concern for marine creatures, that this was having a remarkable impact on what turned out to be one of my favorite marine
climate
creatures.
Change, the impact of a warming Earth.
Yeah.
Before we get into that, I just want to intimately explore your connection to this incredible creature. What makes the polar bear so special to you, and what makes it special amongst bears? And I preface that because, you know, I've been very lucky in my career. I've witnessed some really amazing animals, and I've had a chance to tell those stories of really cool creatures, from big anacondas to sea turtles. And my first moment with the polar bear, when you sit there with a 600-pound polar bear in your lap, thankfully sedated, and you're putting a radio collar on, and you actually watch the snow melt away and the ice melt away from its breath, and you micromanage this incredible creature, it is just humbling and inspiring. For you, what was that spark about this bear, and what makes this bear special?
It has nothing to do with radio collars and nothing to do with having a bear in my lap. When I was considerably younger, all those decades ago, I was so fascinated by polar bears, particularly, that I used to collect them. I used to collect little glass ones, wood carvings. Wherever I went in the world, I would go and see if they had little polar bears, models or carvings or whatever, the Eskimo carvings and Finnish wood carvings of polar bears. And so I had always had what I hope I communicated in the book, this absolute adoration of polar bears. I think they are the most charismatic, exciting creatures on Earth. And so the ability to write a book about them was a gift. I just thought, I was born or made to write this book. I just thought they couldn't have handed me a better, there is no they, but if there was a they and they handed me the subject, I would say they couldn't have handed me
a better. That makes our conversation about intelligent design very easy. So. But was there one moment, or could you tell us about that moment when you first observed? I read about your experience in here, but explain to us, what was that like when you first set eyes on a wild polar bear?
I was on a Russian icebreaker heading for the North Pole, and we had from the deck of the icebreaker, it was 1994, and from the deck of the icebreaker, we had seen bears at a distance as we crunched through the ice. We had left from Kirkenes in northern Norway, took a quick right turn, went into Murmansk, where, incidentally, we saw the remains of the Russian icebreaker fleet, which had been mostly scrapped by that point. But here we are sailing north towards the North Pole, and we could see bears in the distance. And when you're on board a ship and you see a bear from the distance, somebody says, "Ah, a bear, a bear." And you get your binoculars and you're going over here. And he said, "No, no, it's over there. It's over there. That white thing. You see that white thing moving? No, no, not that white thing. That white thing. It's a bear." And this was itself very exciting, because I really don't think that there is another animal that I've had the opportunity to see in the wild, with one exception, and that's tigers. But with that exception, this is the most important wildlife spotting experience I have ever had. And I think it's the same for a lot of other people. Anyway, here we are crunching along to the North Pole, and it's about 5 o'clock, 8 o'clock in the morning, and we come to a stop. And I run downstairs. This ship had many, many decks, and you had to do a lot of running to get down to the deck of the ship. And there are a bunch of people gathered over at the port rail, and they're looking down. So I run over to where they are, and I look down, and there's this bear looking right up at us. As far as the lateral distance, I was as far from the bear as I am from you, but I was 20 feet up on the deck of the ship. Of course, I didn't know what I had run downstairs for, and I didn't bring a camera, so I ran all the way back upstairs and got a camera, and a lot of rolls of film. Remember those little yellow canisters? I had a lot of those, and I brought them down, and I started shooting pictures of this bear. And it was then, and as I say, with the exception of spotting tigers from elephant back, which is, I'm sure you've done that. Well, he has.
And have put radio collars on them. I got radio calls on my kids.
Anyway, it was such an earth moving, shattering experience to be this close to a bear that I ran out of film and I caged more film from other people. And then we continued the trip and we got to the North Pole. But still, the most important element of that trip, it should have been getting to the North Pole, but it wasn't.
It was getting
this bear. And from then on, and with all these photographs, a lot of which are in that book, my photographs, that's not one of them on the cover, though. From then on, I knew that I had to do this. And then, subsequently, when the North Pole where I had stood on solid ice, when I learned that a couple of years later it had
receded
water,
yeah.
I thought, well, this is the moment.
That was
to start,
the catalyst.
Yeah,
that
this
was,
is the moment to start thinking about global warming, climate change, and how it affects polar bears.
I think we definitely should make the very timely topic of climate change a part of this conversation tonight. But before we begin, I don't think, unless you've ever really truly witnessed a polar bear, maybe if you're lucky enough to witness one in the wild, it's hard to truly grasp how perfectly designed they are for their world, how almost magical they are in the way they just blend and melt into the landscape and move with incredible speed. I mean, these creatures which can take a 200, 300 pound seal and pull it, as you talked about this, but pull it through a hole this big. You know, I sort of described to my daughter what's that like to take, you know, 3 feet, 6 feet of ice and pull a giant animal through that. And I said, well, it's sort of like sending our cat through a pastry bag. I mean, if you could do it, you shouldn't. Because the ESPSA would not like that. But tell us a little bit about the incredible, rapid, amazing evolutionary journey that has taken an ancient brown bear, possibly, to this bear we see today. Tell us about its journey.
It's an incredible journey, largely because it happened so fast. As far as bear paleontologists, that's paleontologists who study bears, not paleontologists who are bears, but as far as bear paleontologists are concerned, this whole journey took about 300,000 years. And we are used to thinking of evolutionary journeys in terms of millions of years. For example, the sperm whale that I've about to write about, the sperm whale's development took 25 million years. Some 300,000 years ago, we think, a population of ordinary brown bears, for some reason unknown to us, migrated north. And when they got there, they began to do this evolutionary dance that people understand, but it usually takes a great deal of time. This is what happened to the polar bear, to the brown bear, in this very short period of time. First of all, it turned from brown to white. Then it changed shape. Its head got longer, its neck got longer, its legs got longer. It lost the hump on its back that brown bears have. It developed hollow hairs instead of the solid hairs that brown bears have. It developed hair on the soles of its feet. It developed a diet that perforce was different from that of brown bears, because when they got there, there wasn't anything. Why they went there is a question no one will ever be able to answer, because brown bears are omnivores. Brown bears and black bears eat roots and berries and shrubs and leaves and carrion and animals when they can catch them, but they can eat anything. Brown bears, by the time they turned into polar bears, could eat nothing but meat, because there was nothing but meat up there. There are only seals and walruses and whale carcasses and an occasional caribou. There isn't anything else for them to eat, so they had to develop what are called obligate carnivores, and they have all the equipment. They developed all the equipment to do this. They have all the shearing teeth, the carnassial teeth. that other big predators have, the lions and tigers have, and great big canines, and so they are perfectly designed. We use that term advisedly, but still, they are perfectly designed for the life they lead. On the other hand, shouldn't be that much of a surprise, though, because everything is perfectly designed
and
for the life
they lead.
And they
didn't have a choice. Yeah, you were going to make it up there, and the elements, it was the ultimate test to survive up there. Mm-hmm. that you're either going to pull it off in a very truncated, rapid period of time.
Or disappear. Right.
Fall prey to
extinction.
But they
made it. That's the fascinating part about the story. They made it through this process of change. On the other hand, everything else did the same thing. Every animal that you look at, from a dingo to a giraffe, has to have adapted itself to the environment in which it lives. Otherwise, it would be extinct. But this is such a quick story with such a glorious, ending.
Perhaps could have, you know, in a more stable environment, might have taken many millions of years.
Yeah.
But here it happens in a matter of a few hundred thousand years, you get this incredible creature that is adapted just wonderfully to this place. Explain the world of the polar bear. How hostile is it?
Well, it's probably the most hostile environment on Earth. There's nothing grows there, first of all. It's all ice and snow all the time. You're a bear now, you have to be able to figure out how to earn a living in a place that is all ice and snow all the time. So they developed all of these adaptations that enabled them to do this. For example, female polar bears den up, first of all, they become impregnated, they den up for 4 or 5 months at a time without eating. They eat nothing. They live on the fat that they've stored from eating the fat, particularly of seals. Adult polar bears don't eat the meat of seals. They eat the fat only. Juvenile bears, which need the meat and the protein to grow, eat the meat of the seal, but the adult polar bears don't. They eat the fat because they need this cushion. One thing I didn't mention about adaptations of polar bears have a blubber layer like whales. Other bears don't. Brown bears don't. Polar bears do. They have a thick layer of fat. So when the female dens up, she lives on that fat. She eats nothing. She lives on that fat. She nurses the cubs. When they're born, they're about the size of rabbits. They nurse in this den for 4 or 5 months under the snow. She digs a hole in the snow, goes in there and stays there for 4 months, gives birth to these cubs. When they're big enough to forage on their own, they can't feed themselves yet, but when they're big enough to forage on their own, she pops out of the den and immediately starts eating. This is altogether different. No other bear, probably no other animal, does anything like that. But it's one of the modifications that polar bears had to develop in order to survive and to prosper in this impossible environment.
Do you think it's interesting how you have this incredibly, just perfectly modeled bear to live in this very austere, unforgiving environment? It is just, I mean, even when we classify it scientifically, even though it is a bear, it's a member of the bear, the ursid family, it's really, we consider it a marine mammal in some cases.
Well, we should, and we should consider it a marine mammal because there are some marine mammals that never come out of the water, as you know. Whales, dolphins, and manatees stay in the water all their lives. And they come out of the water, they're in trouble. Other marine mammals, seals, sea lions, sea otters, walruses, spend some time in the water, then they come out of the water. Polar bears would be not classified as marine mammals if they came on land, but they don't. They come out on frozen water. So whether they're in the water or on top of the water, they spend their entire lives associated with water. And you can't get to be much more of a marine mammal than that.
And incredibly adapted for a marine life. I mean, these creatures can swim up to, 60 miles a day in some situations. So their characteristics are distinct. And we look at them as just this wonderful, unusual group of bears. Yet, how do you feel about the idea that they can actually breed with other bears and produce viable offspring? You know, often you think they seem so distinct, yet there's still a common bond of genetics that they can interbreed with other bears.
This has happened. There's been, as far as I know, there's been a single grizzly polar bear, a grizzler bear, that was shot. And when they analyzed the DNA of the bear, they found it had equal parts polar bear and grizzly bear DNA. Yes, I think they can breed, but they probably do out of desperation. They probably do in terms of trying to survive, not in this hostile environment, but in this changing environment. They probably find themselves desperate because they're looking for female. Males are looking for females. They spend, that's what they do.
And they find a sow in estrus.
Yeah.
And that's, and the, she's in season, poor, and
they just turn
the lights out. Unfortunately, you can't
up there. A bad dye job or something. But it doesn't happen very often. You can encourage animals.
It's kind of neat, though, because, I mean, you look at something like some of the equine animals, and they look very similar, but if you cross them, they produce sterile offspring. If you take a horse and a donkey and you get a mule, you know, it can't reproduce, but you get these just very unusually unique groups, but yet they still have some common history.
Well, remember,
that
it's only 300,000 years that the polar bear diverged from the grizzly bear, and that's not a lot of time for the DNA to get so seriously modified. They're much closer, much more closely related than we think they are.
Right.
They just look different.
Now, you mentioned the word polar bears in desperate situations, which is sort of an interesting segue into the next topic I want to explore. What is the future of the polar bear? Do you see a future? And try to just interpret the reality of climate change and its impact on polar bears. Why can't they just move south?
Well, they probably can. That's what some of them are doing. A polar bear 2 weeks ago came ashore at the Isle of Mull in Scotland. That's pretty far from polar bear territory. Polar bears have been spotted in Iceland, a bad idea for a polar bear because no matter what everybody else thinks about Iceland, it's mostly lava covered with with one very large glacier, which, by the way, is melting badly. But the rest of Iceland is black. It's lava. And if you're a polar bear coming out of the water, the last thing you want to do is stand out like a polar bear on lava. And so what happens is people are terrified of these big, scary bears, and they shoot them. They shot three of them in Iceland. They're showing up in Newfoundland, where they're not supposed to be. They're venturing south. They're crossing the Brooks Range. They're coming south into grizzly territory where they will find nothing to sustain them. This brings up the unfortunate suggestion that why don't we just pick them up and move them to the Antarctic? Yeah. It looks the same, right? A lot of ice and snow. But it's not the same, as you know.
You'd have a lot of unhappy penguins.
You'd have a lot of unhappy penguin protectors is what you have. You're eating all our penguins? Are you crazy? Yeah. You turned loose this penguin-eating machine? So that's not going to work. And of course, as you know, every time human beings have tried to interfere with nature by moving something from the place it was originally to where they think it ought to be, the results have been disastrous.
It would be marched to the penguin buffet, basically, if you made it down there. But I think sometimes we get insulated in our own world and we don't truly experience the impact that climate change is having on our world. And I think many of us look to the polar bear because it is this sort of canary in the coal mine for the state of that part of the world. It's the perfect indicator species of what happens when this incredible place just literally melts away beneath their feet. But some would argue there's 25,000 polar bears, maybe a few here, a few more or less. That's pretty stable, that maybe they don't need protection. What is your argument that we should protect polar bears and we still need to flesh out how climate change impacts them?
Well, I think that it is a straw man to think that we need a reason to protect a species. I've never believed that we need a reason. I think it's our obligation to protect a species, just as it is our obligation, an even stronger one, not to eliminate a species. This is not what we were put on this earth to do, if anything. But it certainly wasn't to decide which species should live and which species should not live. So I think the fact that what we've been talking about, that the incredible journey of the polar bear, is more than enough reason to protect them. They struggled to get where they are, to be polar bears, to colonize this impossible territory, and to decide, well, now we don't need them anymore, or who cares about them. The fact that they did this, the fact that they exist, is enough reason to protect them. What is happening, though, is having not It's not being done to eliminate the polar bears. What's being done is to modify the climate in such a way that the polar bear habitat is disappearing. And we certainly have no right to do that, specifically because what will happen to the environment, the polar bear's environment, will affect us. It's not an isolated case. It's not just, oh, these big silly white bears up there, and so if there are fewer of them, who cares? If the polar ice cap melts, as it is doing, we are going to see, as we are seeing, changes in climate that will affect everybody, and they will not be promising. They will not be good changes in climate. The exaggerators are the people who say, well, when the polar ice caps melt, the sea level is going to rise by 6 feet, which will inundate places like New York and Boston and everything else. 6 feet more of permanent water level will drown New York City. And this will happen. It may happen 10,000 years from now, but we're on that track now. And the people who argue, well, there have always been climate changes, there are cycles, we used to have ice ages, now we don't have ice ages. This is the first time that any of this was created by human beings. Yes, there have been ice ages, there have been extinctions. There have been more than a few extinctions. 99.9% of all the animals that have ever lived on Earth are extinct now, and for the most part, we didn't have anything to do with it. But here we are changing the Earth's climate. We are changing the Earth's climate. We're going to lose the polar bears in the process. We're going to lose weather systems in the process. We're going to lose cities, not immediately. I mean, you don't have to batten down your dock because the water is going to end up in your house. But this is what's happening now, and it is not stoppable.
So if it's not stoppable, is there hope for the polar bear?
No.
You think there's no hope for the polar bear?
I don't. I think there's no hope for the polar bear. I think that we will continue to see polar bears. There are some 22,000 of them that are supposed to be around, and I'm not likely to accept Sarah Palin's count on this subject. She's up to 40,000 by now.
She's using both hands.
And the Russian bear she can see from her house.
Well, that sort of brings us to an interesting point in the moments that we have left. We have national regulations which are designed to protect species which ultimately represent the national natural heritage of our region and of our planet. These are the resources which we cherish, which we sustainably use in some situations, and ultimately, I think we would agree that our mission is to ensure that the next generation has a chance to be stewards of these incredible species. So we have these regulations, like the Endangered Species Act, ESA. We have, and of course, there was a recent change with polar bears within that. We have CITES, the Convention for the International Trade of Endangered Species.
Worked pretty well for polar bears,
well,
didn't it?
Well, that's my question. Here is this incredible umbrella that's designed. The CITES, which is the Convention for the International Trade of Endangered Species, is basically the filter for which we measure the stability of a species and how it can be used or protected. And explain to us what has happened recently with two things you care about, tuna and polar bears.
Well, I care about a lot of things, but yeah. At the recent CITES meeting, earlier this year, they voted down proposals to list polar bears and bluefin tuna as Category 1 for CITES, which means that you cannot trade them as international trade. In other words, the New England fishermen could not, under CITES, should it have been passed, could not sell bluefin tuna to the Japanese, which, as you know from your Massachusetts experience, is a great big deal for Massachusetts fishermen. But that was voted down. CITES voted that down. CITES voted down the protection for the polar bear. So they're not, you can still trade in them as endangered species. You can shoot a polar bear in Canada and bring its skin or teeth or whatever it is into some other country. CITES would have prevented that. So here you are with this possibility of preserving. I mean, I'd love what you said about cherishing wildlife and passing it along to the next generation so they too can be the stewards. But I don't think that our current generation has been responsible stewards. We let all this stuff slip through our hands. It's nice to think about how we could have done it, should have done it. But I don't know very many endangered animals that are being actually saved nowadays. I mean, there are projects, as you know, there are projects just to save whooping cranes and projects to save California condors. But a lot of creatures that are endangered are continuing to be. And I read your book just yesterday, in fact. And while it is a much more positive outlook than mine is, still, you were not able to pinpoint a lot of instances where the stewardship of a particular endangered species was working to save it. Rather, well, here we go. This is another one down the drain here. That's my attitude. I'm sure it's not yours, but I really don't think we've done very well as preserving anything. We've saved the Hornaday, saved the bison in 1900, and now there are a lot of...
Well, I'm not hugely hopeful, but I think having young children, you need to be somewhat of an optimist.
I have a lot of children, thank you.
That brings up population control. Okay, no.
My wife had most of them.
But we live in a time where many scientists would argue that we are in what is called the sixth extinction. We lose an incredible amount of life. There's one statistic out there that says we could be losing a species of life once every 20 minutes. So we have this great plethora of incredible species just disappearing before our eyes. How do we decide who gets to stay? Who gets to go? I kind of look at where we are in conservation is that we're not in a state of luxury. It's almost like the ultimate battlefield triage frontline situation. How important are polar bears? Why should we do our best to save them?
We should do our best to save everything. I don't think we have to make choices between polar bears and condors or whooping cranes and ivory-billed woodpeckers. I think that we need another and a better view of the natural world in which we live. If I could, I would quote the entire Henry Beston quote at you, but I never can. In any event, it's about how we need a better view of animals that share the splendor and travail of the earth. We shouldn't have the right to sit here and decide which animals to save, largely because in those instances where we could devote all our resources to saving, let's assume we all voted to save the polar bear. Could we? The only way we can save the polar bear, which is to preserve its environment, which is
melting away,
is to stop driving, stop manufacturing, stop boating, and stop airplanes tomorrow. That could conceivably reverse the global warming trend. It is about as likely as my sprouting wings and flying out of this room, however, because we're not going to do any of those things. And the reason we're not going to do any of them is because I don't think enough people care. I don't think enough people got the message. Enough people can say, oh, well, who cares? Polar bears, cranes, Tasmanian devils, they're ugly anyway. Who cares about them? The cancer abuse.
They're actually quite adorable. I've taken care of a few Tasmanians.
They're not so adorable with the cancers that they
have. No, that is not, which is quite terrifying how many of these species basically are illustrating the process of extinction they're experiencing and how it may very well illustrate the future or lack thereof for our own species. I think you touch on an important point, which is maybe how we build a better relationship between human beings and these very important species. So how important or not important do you think zoos are? Do you think there's a value to, for example, a child going to a zoo in an inner city and seeing a polar bear in captivity?
I think it used to serve a much more important function, just as natural history museum dioramas used to serve a more important function. You couldn't see these creatures any other way. You could see the frozen animals in the dioramas, or an animal in a zoo hiding behind a rock or fast asleep, and you could say that's better than not seeing it at all. But I think zoos and natural history museums have taken by far a secondary place to nature films. And your stuff, for example, gets people to see what an anaconda actually looks like, not one that's permanently under a piece of plastic in a natural history museum and not moving. So I think we've seen a very substantial evolution of the way we approach the natural world. And I think what's happening here is, as animals become extinct, and we're going to watch, as you say, there's extinctions all the time. They're not the charismatic megafauna that are becoming extinct all the time. There are a lot of things nobody knows about some things are becoming extinct before they've even been discovered, in fact. Some insect species, obviously. But if there's a lesson here, it is, as far as I'm concerned, it's that we have to pay attention to what's happening. And if we lose the polar bear, as I suspect we will, and if we lose Tasmanian devils, then we're going to lose a lot now, because we care not enough. We care about the wrong things. And what I do and what you do is to try and raise awareness, to try and show the world at large why they ought to care about polar bears or anacondas or red wolves or whatever they are, and not enough people care. But perhaps if we lose these creatures, if polar bears actually are gone, perhaps the lesson will be learned. Maybe we didn't pay enough attention. Maybe not to me or not to you, but to the fact that we're losing things, and our irresponsible attitudes are responsible for the loss of this charismatic creature. It's gone. So that would be the lesson, if there is one, from the potential extinction of the polar bear, and that is pay attention, because we're going to lose more things unless we learn to pay attention, unless we learn to fix things.
So perhaps by watching this creature struggle to survive, we, in the end, maybe through tragedy, gain the wisdom to better manage what remains.
I certainly hope so.
Well, on that note, Richard Ellis, thank you very much for spending an evening with us.
Thank you.
Cheers. Vodka.